The decade after the end of World War I was particularly awful for race relations in America. There were anti-black pogroms in Washington, Chicago, and a dozen other cities in 1919, the burning of Black Tulsa in 1921, the imposition of segregation in neighborhoods across the urban North, the rise of the Ku Klux Klan in both the North and the South, and lynchings that claimed 400 lives in 10 years. But it was also when the Harlem Renaissance began, when a group of writers, artists, and musicians worked to reveal the vibrancy of African-American culture. You might be surprised to learn that a small group of upper-class white women also played a role in the movement, and Carla Kaplan's new book, Miss Anne in Harlem, The White Women in the Black Renaissance, tells the stories of these women who embraced black culture as patrons and participants, only to have their contributions lost in history. It's published by Harper. I'm very pleased to welcome Carla Kaplan to our show today. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
You say the story of these women was a secret hiding in plain sight. So was it easy to find it?
It was not easy to find it. It was fairly easy to notice that it was missing. I had been working on Zora Neale Hurston for years, annotating her letters. And Zora Neale Hurston always prided herself on having interracial friendships. It's very important to her symbolically. It was kind of a proof that this could be done. And I was looking for these white women friends of hers. And I kept noticing they were really hard to find. And then I went looking for them, found that there had been about five dozen of these women who really took Harlem into the center of their lives.
So you said about 60 women. You focused on six.
Exactly.
Because these were the most prominent of the group?
No, not at all. There were some women who were much more prominent. Mary White Ovington, white founder of the NAACP, something not everybody knows, was much more prominent. Amy Spingarn was prominent. But many of these white women who journeyed into Harlem, made Harlem the center of their lives, built their lives around the black explosion of arts that was the Harlem Renaissance, particularly the older generation of women, they felt that they could only be effective in a black community if they kept an extremely low profile.
They were collectively called Miss Anne.
Yes.
This sounds to me like it was meant to be derogatory.
Absolutely. Miss Anne is the counterpart for the expression Mr. Charlie or Mr. Eddie. And I think those are phrases that remain pretty well known in the white community. Miss Anne, you used to be able to get the race of any room by dropping the phrase Miss Anne. If you drop it in a room full of black folks, everybody snickers. You drop it in a room full of white folks, everybody looks at you completely blankly, which I think is interesting. It still points to the fact that we live, to some extent, in two divided worlds.
Was the presence of these women common knowledge in Harlem?
Very much so. Some of these women were influential enough and important enough that their presence was impossible to miss. The main female patron of the Harlem Renaissance, who I write about in this book, Charlotte Osgood Mason, who is exemplary of the complicated relationships of money and the Renaissance, everybody knew about her and nobody was allowed to speak of her. So they were quite well known at the time.
Well, one of the women involved, Nancy Cunard, came from the Cunard shipping family. She was really famous. She knew pretty much every major artist of her time, had affairs with a whole bunch, I think, with Hemingway and a few others. But she really threw herself into this. She must have been noticed.
Nancy Cunard was noticed so strongly that one of the first things that happened to her when she was in New York is that she returned to her hotel room to find bundles and bundles and bundles of hate mail, threatening to kill her for her interest in Black Harlem, threatening to do, you know, all kinds of violence to her. Their Klan said, "We're coming to get you." And she had to scoot out to the countryside just for safety for about a month. Taking this strong an interest, exactly as you say, the kind of committed and passionate interest in black life that these women were taking was a taboo that was so absolute, it made people crazy.
Well, when I look at Nancy Cunard's history with lovers like Wyndham Lewis, Aldous Huxley, Tristan Zara, Louis Aragon, but also Ezra Pound, who was extremely he threw his lot in with the fascists at the end of his life. It comes as a surprise that she became such an activist? Was it because of the Scottsboro Boys case? Is that what turned her around?
The thing that turned her around, and it was something I found in three of the women I write about, three of the six, what she claims made her first interested in black culture, and it was originally African culture that she became fascinated by, were a set of dreams. We have to remember this is a period in which people were really listening to their dreams. And Nancy Cunard, Josephine Schuyler, and Charlotte Mason all have these profound dreams of connecting to African culture. And Nancy says that she followed those dreams into first jazz, which was the avenue that most whites used to get to Black Harlem, and then into having a black lover who was a jazz musician named Henry Crowder. And through Henry, she became fascinated with the Harlem Renaissance.
Well, it's interesting that jazz was segregated in Harlem.
Absolutely.
Black people could not sit in the audience with the whites at the Cotton Club.
Yeah.
So any white woman who was hanging out in black clubs would have been noticed immediately, wouldn't she?
You're exactly
right.
And
people would have made assumptions about her, which often perhaps were true.
You're pointing to two really crucial things that were part of the conditions these women were facing at the time. One is this incredible paradox of racial segregation in Black Harlem. On the one hand, Harlem was the mecca for the nation and for the world for black cultural expression and politics as the site of self-determination and self-definition, but there was a vogue for white slumming and white tourism. So you have the mecca of self-determination and you have places like the Cotton Club where only white patrons are allowed, right? This is a crazy contradiction to wrap our minds around. At the same time, you have this small group of women doing this very high visible crossing over because they didn't just want to be part of Harlem. They thought they could claim blackness in a certain way.
Well, how were they looked upon by the people in their white social circles?
Oh, very badly. Very badly indeed. One of the reasons I focus on the six I focus about is they exemplify the range of ways white women used to get into Harlem, but they also exemplify the cost that white women paid for crossing that line.
And you say that Miss Anne was considered a nuisance on both sides of the color line.
Absolutely. She was a nuisance to white people who considered her, in essence, a race traitor. Here was somebody claiming that blackness was better and that she could be partly black. But in that attempt to volunteer for blackness, to say, okay, I want to be black too, she was a nuisance to African Americans because at the time, everybody was living inside a contradiction. And the contradiction was, this is the moment when blacks are attempting to prove to white society that race is a myth. Race is what we now call a construction. But they were also celebrating blackness.
And I would assume for black women who saw them as as threats in some cases for attractive men, they were intruders.
Absolutely.
And they would take advantage of, unfortunately, racial stereotypes.
Absolutely. And it wasn't just black women, although black women certainly saw them as intruders in that light. But this was a period in which many black organizations, including the NAACP, were not particularly excited about intimate interracial relations because they felt like this didn't look good and this was a problem politically.
My guest is Carla Kaplan, whose latest book is Miss Anne in Harlem, The White Women of the Black Renaissance. It is published by Harper. But men were not seen that way. Wasn't Walter White, who led the NAACP for a quarter of a century, blonde and blue-eyed? He was praised for being a voluntary Negro.
Such an excellent question. It goes in two ways. Walter White was praised for being a voluntary Negro because he did have black ancestry. And what Miss Anne didn't understand is that voluntary Negro was a term for black people who refused to be seen as white. And they were praised for claiming loyalty to their race. But also, you're exactly right. White men were encouraged to go slumming in Harlem. White men were encouraged to take a little dose of black culture almost medicinally. It was supposed to give them more life and more juice.
And you mentioned that Mary White Ovington was one of the founders, a major founder of the NAACP, and she's been largely forgotten.
She has. She partly engineered that. She did not want to draw a great deal of attention to herself. Politically, she felt it would be a mistake. But it's also a piece of Black history that we haven't known quite what to do with, that the founder of the NAACP is a white woman.
Passing for white was the subject of one of the most famous books of the time by Fanny Hurst, who was also one of the women who could be called a Miss Anne.
Absolutely. And I think Fanny Hurst got it wrong. The passing story in Black hands worked very differently. In Black hands, the Black character who passes for white finds out that it's not very interesting over there in white culture and inevitably longs to go home to the Black community. Fanny Hurst totally missed that. She writes about a Black woman who passes for white and experiences no longing to go home to Blackness. And in that way, she gives herself away. She got everything wrong about the trope.
On the other hand, it was a very popular film, a bestseller, yeah. Made into at least two films.
Two films. It was called A Sensation in Harlem. It was a runaway bestseller. And Hearst took great advantage of that. It gave her a platform as a civil rights speaker that she would never have had otherwise. And in fact, it widened her sphere as a woman.
Did Black and white women work together for the at that time for the fight for women's issues like women's suffrage?
It was a very tense time for women around those issues. This is a period in which many Black women felt betrayed by white feminists and felt that the cause of Black women had been sort of sacrificed to a white feminist movement. So it was a very difficult time. They did work together to end lynching, and there were some wonderful activist models of white women, actually going back to abolition. But these were very small groups, and they were rare. It was rare to find organizations where Black and white women worked together for very long.
We just recently had as a guest on our show Deborah Spar, the current president of Barnard. She was talking about modern-day feminism and how women's lives have changed over the past 50 years. Do you think that the struggles Miss Anne faced in her time were feminist issues?
I do think in some ways they were feminist struggles. One of the reasons Miss Anne did what she did and crossed into Black Harlem was to gain a certain kind of freedom for herself that she couldn't have in white society. Because once she made a place for herself in a Black community, if she did, if she succeeded, nobody there was going to tell her what to do. And so she bought herself a kind of a wider sphere by playing race off against gender, if you will. So I do think that was part of what some of these women were looking for.
It is interesting that the creation of Barnard is part of this story.
Absolutely part of this story. The founder of Barnard, Annie Nathan Meyer, wrote one of the most important radical Black plays of her era. It was so radical, the Provincetown Playhouse couldn't stage it for almost 10 years.
Black Souls.
Black Souls.
Where was it staged finally?
It was finally staged at the Provincetown Playhouse, but it closed after 9 showings because it was considered so wildly controversial.
Why?
There were two things in it that were considered almost unthinkable at her time. One was that she shows a young white woman sexually attracted to a Black man at a time when to show that on the American stage was considered impossible. And this young woman, whose name is Luella, throws herself into a Black man's arms and asks him, to break all of the taboos. But the other thing Black Souls did that was almost as shocking at the time is that it depicted white women as monsters, as complicit with the lynching of Black men, and as monstrous figures. And this hadn't been seen.
There were women who were functioning as patrons of some of the more promising writers. Did that cause complications for someone like Langston Hughes or Alan Locke or Zora Neale Hurston, for that matter?
One of the part of the history we have known for a long time is the history of those complications, because you can imagine how difficult it was at a period of black self-definition and self-determination if the money is coming from white patrons. And this was not just from Charlotte Mason, but from Carl Van Vechten and Alfred and Blanche Knopf and others, right? But one of the surprises of my book and the surprises of my research was how much these black proteges truly loved Charlotte Mason. They couldn't manufacture that. They really loved this woman, and that's part of the difficulty of the story.
One of the women, Lillian E. Wood, was thought to have been an African-American for 100 years until somebody figured out that wasn't true.
And one of the reasons for that, it's very similar to the Black Souls story. And like Annie Nathan-Meyer and her play Black Souls, Lillian Wood's Let My People Go was also a very radical anti-lynching novel in which white women are depicted as monsters for being complicit with racial violence. And everyone assumed that that had to be written by a black woman.
Now, not all of the women, we have very little time, but I did want to get Josephine Cogdill Schuyler into the story. She's a Texas heiress, comes to New York. Well, she's been to some other places as well, but comes here and marries George Schuyler, a black man, collaborates in his work, but takes no credit for her contribution?
Well, not only takes no credit for the contribution she clearly made to her husband's writing, both journalism and novels, but she also wrote under six or so pseudonyms herself. She wrote under the name, among others, of Julia Jerome, who was the black Ann Landers of her day, and was giving all of this advice to black women about their relationships, but was actually white Josephine Schuyler.
What's been the reaction to this book? Because so much of the celebration of the Harlem Renaissance, rightly so, is about the fact that it made Americans aware of just how rich black culture was, not just jazz, but the full range of culture.
I think that people who are fascinated by the Harlem Renaissance in the 20s are glad to have a missing piece revealed, and it is the missing gap or the hole in our history. And also it complicates our picture, and people are saying, well, this changes the Harlem Renaissance.
David Levering Lewis has called the Harlem Renaissance civil rights by copyright.
Yes.
Because suddenly, because of it, so many important writers wound up being published.
It's a perfect phrase.
And your favorite, Zora Neale Hurston, well, she's an interesting story in other ways because she ends her life in the John Birch Society.
Not quite. I mean, she does do some writing for them at a point at which she's writing for anybody who will pay her. But yes, there are some shockers in her end of life.
It shows that there are complications all over the world. Carla Kaplan will be giving a talk and signing books tonight at 7 at the Barnes & Noble store on 82nd Street and Broadway. Her book, Miss Anne in Harlem, The White Women of the Black Renaissance, is published by Harper. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you so much for having me.